Thank you so much for listening to Urbanistica podcast. I am Mustafa Sharif, an urban planner, and you're more than welcome to join my big journey of exploring the making of smarter and more livable cities. Please don't forget to follow Urbanistica on the different social media platforms, and also let's connect on LinkedIn. Big thanks to Urbanistica podcast partner, AFRI. AFRI is an international engineering and design company providing sustainable solutions in the fields of energy, industry, and infrastructure. Are you ready for a new episode? Let's go for it. Hello and welcome back, Professor Tiganon, to Urbanistica podcast.
Thank you very much, Mustafa. It's always good to come back to this very relaxing, enjoyable, and intellectual environment.
Thank you. How are you doing?
Oh, I'm okay. I think I'm, I'm doing well.
Yeah, yeah. And now we have a new book.
That's
congratulations.
Right. Thank you so much. Sort of a post-COVID-19 book.
Yeah, yeah.
I took a little bit longer than we thought, but it finally came out and... I think we're all happy about it.
Yeah.
Although
yeah.
There's always things you could rectify in the when it's printed always. And so on. Also working with specific publishers.
Yeah, yeah. But tell me about the background of making this book. Like how did you get the idea and so on?
Sure. I think Women Reclaiming the City book was born maybe some 15 years ago in my head, or maybe a little bit less.
Okay.
It was for various reasons. Some of the simplest triggers were, I think, one of the talks given to one of our colleagues, my colleague Katja Grindler, professor at the School of Architecture, where she was showing in one of the talks two slides, and on one slide were all these famous male architects.
Okay.
And she asked more or less the audience to recognize them, and of course they're all recognizable.
Mm-hmm.
It was not difficult. Maybe out of 20, you recognize 19. And then the next slide was all female architects throughout history.
Oh.
And you could barely... recognize any of them, at least the audience could say maybe two or three names.
Okay.
And just this was one little bit wake-up call to see that, you know, not just the cities we're living in and they're designed and planned by men, that we live in a sort of very strong patriarchal society, and that we have this sort of also, I would say, injustice when it comes to recognizing great architects, planners that are female.
Yeah.
The other thing was that I think I made a conference, which was rather, I would say, famous in 2004, New Urbanism Beyond, sort of highlighting the new urban planning and design movement that came from the U.S., based very much on neo-traditional principles and transport-oriented development. And I think I brought, I don't like to use the word elite, but really the academic and practitioner elite that represented the movement. And there were also, you know, men and female invited. At the end, out of the 25 keynote speakers, 24 were men. So, and of course, I was the organizer. And I think this was good for me. You learn by your mistakes. And after that, I've never done that again. And I've always been sort of have had a balanced group of people in there. So these were maybe the two little triggers. But I think the idea was, in a sense, really original. And I can't really pinpoint when.
Yeah.
I wanted to have a book by extraordinary urban studies female scholars.
Okay.
And as a caveat, the book was, I already decided it's going to be more or less a Western perspective. So nothing, sort of not excluding the global South, let's say, the African, South American perspective or Asian one. But this was just a conscious decision.
Yeah.
Also, as you've seen from the, as we'll see from the interview or our discussion panel with some of our guests or colleagues from the book, there's an extraordinary body of knowledge that these female scholars have produced, and that generations of scholars in the global North and global South are really working on and also implementing in their practical work.
So what is the mission of this book?
I think the mission is that to break the bonds of this, on one side, I'll probably say structural injustice when it comes to equality of sexes in academia. I think we have had advances, in especially in getting faculty getting a number of professors that are female, get number of urban scholars that are female. We're going towards that quite well.
Yeah.
But when it comes to the body of literature, the books we read, the texts, the projects we look at, I still think there's a discrepancy in that, and especially the way that female scholars and practitioners look at the city is very much different than we men have that perspective. Mm-hmm. There's, a softer, more nuanced perspective on housing issues, of issues of racial inequality, of justice, of transportation, especially of security and safety in public spaces.
Yeah. And how was the selection of the contributors? Like, what is the process or based on what?
Right. The book was basically conceived in the Center for the Future of Places through the Athena Distinguished Scholar Series. And we've had an extraordinary academic board in the center, which was very much balanced between men and women of different, disciplinary perspective. Mm-hmm. We had cultural anthropologists, urban sociologists, planners, urban economists, architects. And together with them and also with our strategic board, we've decided for a number of names, and then I also expanded. I've been in urbanism for almost 25 years, so I have a rather good outlook on the literature and on the scholarly work that has been published. So I think we gathered around 20 names that we thought were really extraordinary. We were very excited about it, and a number of names that we would add in a potential book later on.
Yeah,
series was basically originally conceived for 15, then it grew to 20, then 25, and they all came to Stockholm and presented this. Unfortunately, COVID stopped us with the last few talks we had, but we did them online later on. So it was a decision made by me within the Center of Future Places and also with our academic and strategic board.
Yeah, and what when we open the book, what will we read about? What are the chapters and based on what? What are the topics?
There, it's always this sort of arbitrary the distribution of papers. And I know at the end, sometimes the authors are not always happy. Why am I in this chapter? And I'm just doing, for example, two contributions for Encyclopedia of Regional Science. And my topics were put in completely wrong sections. So I had to tell the editors, you need to actually put open public spaces under cities, not under economic governance or something. So I think at the end, you'll never be always 100% happy how it looks like.
Yeah, yeah.
But we decided on topics in four sections. Mm. And the first sections was we had the politicized spaces and beyond. So it was a lot about politics of urban space, about equality, why public space matters, and about the just city. So those topics were gathered under, I think it's probably seven papers under that first. Mm. The second selection or second section was about contemporary urbanism grounds. And that one had to do more with maybe urban planning and design concrete, looking at objects in spaces, how do we arrange things, everything from walkability to streetscape. So let's say maybe a little bit more of the hardware of the city as opposed to the software. The third one was really about the software, and we called it the new urban social geographies. And that had to do with memorials, the health issues in the city, longevity, body conscious design, and so on, and a little bit of an environmental aspects. And finally, we closed it with issues of dwellings and cultures.
Okay.
Everything from culture of the city, and maybe on everyday urbanism, temporary city, up down to digitalization in society, or this virtual city. So in that way, we kind of tried to cover as much as we could in those four sections.
So if I understand correctly, also like the target group, the people who are going to read this book, like anyone basically working with city making, from planners, designers.
It's true. This reminds me, when you apply for books, apply for suggestions of getting books published, they always ask you about target groups.
Yeah.
We tend to write all kinds of target groups just to get the book maybe published faster or accepted.
Yeah.
But this one was, I would take this as a very just criticism. Mm. It's very academic in a way, because all the colleagues of mine, distinguished colleagues in this book, they're academics.
Yes.
Practitioners, of course, because a lot of their research was done on the ground with different social groups, with different professionals and so on.
Yeah.
But nonetheless, it's an academic language.
Yes.
Based on their research. And of course, some practitioners would say, well, why didn't you make a book of practitioner females? Mm. Because we're the doers and these women are just philosophizing. Yeah, yeah. Which I would say, I'm on the same line as my colleague Neil Brenner from graduate school design at Harvard. He has, I think, put together a very interesting urban theory lab maybe some 10, 15 years ago. He moved to Chicago and came back.
Yeah.
And he always posed, and I think we should go back to his statements, and I like it a lot. We have in urban studies a sort of a field in the intellectual disarray. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of opposing and contesting concepts and categories and you know, ideas going around, which is, of course, fruitful, mm-hmm. but it's very difficult to get stable grounds for something mm-hmm. to be done on the ground.
Okay.
Something to deliver to the practitioners.
Yes. If
so creating new theories and new concepts, or Rem Koolhaas said, if you cannot do that, at least try to get some new terminology in.
Right.
I think that was that. So it's for academics, but it's also for decision makers and practitioners at the end of the day.
Yeah. And together with us today, we have also three of the contributors.
That's right.
Should we connect and talk with them as well?
Absolutely.
Let's do it.
Sure. Good evening, everybody. It's wonderful to have three distinguished female scholars with us, part of the Women Reclaiming the City book and the Athena Scholars series. Professor Seta Low from the Graduate School of City University of New York is with us. Professor Karen Frank from the New Jersey Institute of Technology. And last but not least, Professor Loretta Lees from Boston University here in Boston. And we'll be discussing the Women Reclaiming the City.
Yeah, yeah. So I'm really happy to have you here. And let's start with you, Setha. And I read your chapter. It's amazing. And I love to ask you a few questions. What is the absolutely most important aspect in public space?
The most important aspect is that we don't appreciate it, that it encouraged flourishing at the individual, neighborhood or community and city and even nation level, that if we invested in public space, we could make a difference all the way down from mental health to social justice. And the other most important thing I think about public spaces, I think in terms of investment, I mean, there are lots of things cities need. We need housing, we need a lot of things, but public space, because it impacts so many different things from, you know, the informal economy or sustainability, environmental sustainability, to health and mental health, to recreation, play, creativity, resilience. There are just so many things that public space can change, and that we have evidence that it in fact does change. That if we have very few dollars or thinking globally in developing cities, that I think our first priority is to develop a network of public spaces where people can be together, encounter one another, but also provide all these other benefits. Yeah. I just think it's a lot of, we say in English, a bang for your buck. That means you get a lot for investing in public space, even if those public spaces are not all the same, even if they vary, that ultimately green space and blue space makes a huge difference.
Yeah. And you mentioned in the chapter flourishing. What do you mean by flourishing? How do you define it?
Well, flourishing is a positive psychology concept. And I chose it because I felt it was a little bit more than what we usually as planners and designers think of, because flourishing isn't just doing well. It's thriving. It's being able to, in all dimensions of your life, really expand and grow from, again, this wide, thing, all the way from your health and well-being to having social relations, to being creative, to having occupational availability, let's say.
Yeah.
So I chose flourishing on purpose. To be honest, not sure it's the best word, what I was trying to do, we could say thrive or grow, create, but And I'm particularly interested in social justice, so, you know. But I was trying to think of something that would go across scales. In other words, individual flourishing all the way up to flourishing of a city or a region, that we were thinking of something that would scale up and down.
Yeah, yeah. And we recorded an episode, I think 1 or 2 years ago. And now with your chapter in this book, you mentioned a lot of aspects that public space should deliver to society, like a place for play, festivals, a place for
cultural identity.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But as an urban designer, what should I prioritize? There are a lot of things that I should put, but if I have to prioritize a few aspects, which are the ones?
Here's the way I thought about the book, and I'm not sure exactly what people have read, but in the introduction, I posit a kind of model. It's a heuristic model. It's not a perfect model, but of why it is that public space works in the way it is. Not looking at the outcomes, not looking at the antecedents, but looking at public space as a kind of, dare I say, mediator. And for those who are scientists in the audience, I don't mean in a quantitative way, but still that there are things that happen in public space that take a place, a particular place with certain kinds of demography, certain kind of history, whatever, and can produce the kinds of positive outcomes that the book is really looking at, and negative outcomes. Yeah. It's just that I don't focus on it. And there's three components to that model. And one is very familiar to you as designers, that you design for contact, and that we know that contact really has these kind of liberalizing effects, that it's probably much more important to humans than we ever thought, COVID being the example, but that you design a place where people will come in contact with one another. But what I argue in the book is contact without other elements doesn't necessarily make for a successful or positive or flourishing public space. And that you also need to be thinking about public culture and thinking about how do you design for culture? Well, one thing is to understand what culture is there in the first place, and to look at places that do in fact produce. So it could mean in certain spaces that everybody needs a place to be together, but they also need their own individual places where they can feel identified or attached. In other words, that you as a designer, now I say planner, or as thinking about the spaces. And then finally, I added one more element called affective atmosphere. Not a great term. You're going to find me a better term, one of you, please. That's from the academic jargon. But what we're talking about is how a place feels. And here is where I really think design makes a huge difference. Now, events can make a difference. You know, I use the example of Yankee Stadium. Everybody wins. Everyone's talking to one another. They lose. They stay away. But I do think that designers can be thinking about how do we create a positive atmosphere or an atmosphere where connection can occur. But without public culture or something like it, without this kind of affective atmosphere, which could be done with social media, then the contact isn't going to turn into the attribute. So that's where I think the designer should be thinking, not on the outcomes, but on the space itself and how it is that it transforms into something that is flourishing.
Exactly, with having people and the human in the center when they design. Thanks a lot, Setha. And before we move to the next guest, tell me, I know you're producing books and chapters and so on. What is the latest book you're working on apart from this one?
Okay. Mark McGuire, a colleague of mine, and I just turned in a book called Trapped, T-R-A-P-P-E-D, and it's on the rise of security capitalism and how to escape it. And right now, in 3 days, I have to deliver a book called Beach Politics, which is on environmental social fragility, and it's about how we save now our beaches, our shorelines from incursion.
Interesting. So wish you all the best luck in delivering, and we're looking forward to read it as usual.
Absolutely.
Right?
Yeah. I had one short one, if it's okay.
Yeah.
Which I wanted to ask all three of our colleagues. When you look at public space and the future of public spaces within the feminist planning perspective, Seta, what would you say is the most pertinent thing that needs to be done when it comes to planners, designers, and even academics? What do we need to turn to change?
To change? Well, I mean, Tigran, I'm still hearing, especially in Europe, where I've been spending a lot of time with my colleagues, that women don't feel safe in space.
Yeah.
And in some cases, children, certainly with a turn with guns in the United States or the kinds of conflicts. I mean, one of the things about Gaza that I've written in the book on beach politics is the beach was a safe place for everyone. That was one of the places that women and children could go. So, I mean, it's nothing new. You're asking me to look into the future. But I don't think I need to look into the future until we've really solved the kinds of gendered gay issues. There are lots of people who aren't safe in space. You know, my young men of color in Central Park still don't feel safe. These are the kinds of issues we still have to look at, and that I really haven't taken on, and I think others in our group today will talk maybe more about that, who really know a lot more than I do.
Thank you.
Yes, and we move on to Karin, and your contribution to this book is more focused on memorials and monuments, like more on the objects in a public space or a square. Tell us why people engage differently.
Okay, I would like to emphasize it's not about objects. It's about the space.
Yes.
Okay, and it happens that the space often has today in memorials very interesting arrangements. For example, the Vietnam Veterans Memorial in Washington, D.C., which really, I would say, brought home the advantages of a more spatial memorial that people could walk through, and also that listed the names, the individual names of those who died. And I went there before it was even finished, and I was just taken aback by what I would say what a memorial can be. And I was also taken aback by how people interacted with it, touched the names, left items there, often flags, but often clothing or other, I don't know what to say it, belongings from the person who died. And in fact, those have been collected and are in an archive that one can make an appointment to visit. That is just amazing to me, that attention. So then when the September 11 memorial was built, a similar design approach was taken with individual names. And of course, there was a tremendous issue of which names and how they should be arranged next to each other in groups. It took a lot of careful mathematical algorithmic work to group the names. And again, items were collected, but now that museum is in great financial difficulty and it's closed. So this whole engagement with something so physical and so emotional really, really still moves me. Now, there's always an issue of, has it been designed right?
Yeah.
And for the Vietnam Veterans Memorial, certainly veterans were involved in it. But only male veterans, not surprisingly. So eventually another, in this case, statue had to be added. The other issue, of course, was that many veterans thought that this black wall was demeaning. So again, a statue had to be added. So what also strikes me is that compared to other design projects in the world, like buildings, the general public is just much more involved. This goes back even to the efforts to build a memorial to Franklin Delano Roosevelt. That took a tremendous number of years. I think it's 40 years. And it turns out to be a memorial that you can walk through and touch. Mm. I just am, when I prepared for this session, I thought, I've done a whole book, right? Memorials of Spaces of Engagement.
Yeah.
But I can't stop thinking about this, particularly with your questions.
Yeah. So if you can mention like some aspects that makes people engaged and love to be there, love to touch, to stay there.
Well, I think I've talked about some of them, that they can reach the names. Well, for the Vietnam Veterans Memorial, they can't reach all of them because it's very tall. But people do go up on top, which is kind of dangerous, and try to reach down. I think you're prevented from doing that. That you can come so close that in some cases the design, it wasn't on purpose, I don't think, but it happens in the September 11 memorial, the way the names are engraved, you can stick things into those names.
Okay.
A flower, maybe a small flag. Mm. And of course people leave things there too, but that you can actually put things in there.
Attach, yeah.
You know, I'm thinking now it's like a shrine. Mm. It's a modern version of a shrine. I've never thought of it that way before, but it really is quite amazing. And that both people who were asked to participate in the development of the design, and then when it was publicized, people who were connected with it, who were outraged by certain things. Mm. I mean, eventually, I think with the September 11 memorial, I think Mayor Bloomberg had to step in and make some decisions. This is just remarkable to me.
Yeah.
Remarkable.
Yeah. And how?
Another example that I would throw out there is the memorial to the murdered Jews of Europe in Berlin. Mm. And that project took a tremendously long time. And Peter Eisenman stuck through the whole time, but Richard Serra, a sculptor, was not used to that kind of process, and he bowed out. And in that place, people climb on those stela and jump and do things that are really not safe. Mm. And they're very concerned there, since it's the memorial to the murdered Jews of Europe, not for the guards to intervene too aggressively. So again, you have this dilemma between people using the space and then doing it in a way that's both dangerous and some people find sacrilegious.
Yeah, yeah. But how can we find the common ground, let's say, between the users and the aim of, like, a designer design for a purpose?
I don't think a common ground is a goal. I think as long as there's input, and as long from an organized group, and as long as there's chance for the public to respond before it's built, or to respond enough after that it may be modified. For example, the memorial to Princess Diana in Hyde Park is a fountain, a circular fountain, oval. And people started walking in it. And that was quite dangerous for slipping. So Hyde Park stepped in and changed that surface so it's not so slippery. I just find all of that negotiation and trying to find a solution. I mean, some memorials, some monuments are insulting to certain groups. Mm-hmm. That's true in Santa Fe. A monument was built to Civil War soldiers, and it referred to savage natives. Mm. And somebody excised that. That's the other thing. The public goes in and makes a change.
Yeah.
And then that was toppled in 2020 on Indigenous Peoples Day. It was just thrown over. Mm. This is just amazing, this connection between the monument and the people.
Yeah, yeah. I love to take the chance to ask you, because many people ask me to ask you this question and to raise up this topic. I'm from Baghdad, And many years ago, we had the dictatorship, Saddam Hussein, and he had a lot of statue of him in different cities and public squares and so on, and about wars that he did. And now, afterwards, some of them still there, of like picturing some of the wars or some of the things happening during his dictatorship. The new government wants to remove this. Some people want them to stay to remind us. Some of them know it reminds us of like a bad time. How can we think there?
How can we what?
Think. Should we keep? Should we remove? Should we change?
I don't think we can make a should statement overall.
Okay.
I would say there's some very interesting examples. One is Memento Park in Budapest, where they have collected statues built to Marx and Lenin. To me, that's just ingenious. But some people, and then for Robert E. Lee Memorial as a Confederate general in the South, that's been a big dilemma. And particularly during the Black Lives Matter, in Richmond, Virginia, there was a pedestal, and members of the community went and wrote graffiti on that pedestal. And then they hung the victims of police violence around the fence. And they also established a little community garden in the lawn. Now, eventually, the whole thing was taken down.
Yeah.
And I don't know if the statue is in storage or not. Another possibility is to put the statue in a cemetery. And this is true of some Robert E. Lee monuments. And then there's a new book that really throws me, called Smashing Statues, The Rise and Fall of American Public Monuments by Erin Thompson. And in there, she talks about the value of destroying them completely and turning them to dust.
Okay.
I don't go along with that. No. I mean, what are you saying? What are you saying?
That's a weird
book. Killing the past?
So you are more into like keeping some things that remind us of the past.
But commenting on it.
Yeah.
Not letting it just stand.
Okay.
Putting it in some kind of context. Now, when they put the Robert E. Lee statues in cemeteries, I'm not sure there's any plaque there. The Santa Fe Monument, for a while before it was toppled, had this historic, justification of the original statue.
Yeah.
Well, this is how we thought in those days. Again, that's gone.
Yeah.
So that's the other interesting thing. I just thought of that. The life of a single monument over time.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, very interesting. And my question to you now about books. Tell us more about your recent book.
Well, the recent book was a work of love. This is the book. It's called Routledge Handbook of Urban Public Space.
Yeah, yeah.
And many of the chapters are written by my former PhD students based on their dissertations.
Nice.
And because they came from different countries,
yeah,
they drew their information from cases in different countries. I'm afraid none from Iraq, but certainly Turkey and China and Taiwan.
Yeah.
And Brazil, I mean, a number of countries. And I was very keen, I'm always very keen on how we should organize books, particularly one so big. So it's organized into 6-7 parts.
Yeah.
Emerging types of public spaces. I'm fascinated by the whole typing phenomenon. Recreation, commerce, protest, living.
Okay.
Celebration and research methods. And to put the section on living in public space in there, that's living in Santa Cruz, outdoors, homeless, what we call unhoused people, living in the streets of Kinshasa,
yeah,
and also in Paulo, Brazil. I mean, I just...
Beautiful.
and I did this with a former PhD student of mine, Taisheng Huang. I couldn't have done it without him. The details, just beyond my pay grade.
Yeah, yeah, great. Thank you so much, Karin. And we move to Loretta.
I would like to make one correction.
Please.
I'm retired.
Okay. Great. So, Loretta, I read your chapter, and I love that you also explained to us more, because for me it was like there's a huge challenge when it comes to comparative urbanism. So let's start firstly, so you can tell our listener what does it mean.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting following off the back of Karin talking about the value of different students from different parts of the world, talking about urban public space. You know, I mean, comparison has always and long been at the center of urban studies. You know, we're almost obsessed in kind of looking for similarities and differences between cities, you know, and that's quite normal. You know, we're kind of, you know, these kind of binaries are kind of embedded in the way that we kind of socially construct language and thought and other things. So if you go back to kind of some of the key figures in kind of what we might now call classic comparative urbanism,
yeah.
You know, we can think about sociologists like, I guess, Charles Tilly, Janet Abu-Lughod, Charles Pick-Vance. And their work, you know, kind of looked at some of the kind of methodological intricacies of trying to do a good comparative analysis, what it might look like, what it might be. They were also interested in the kind of issue of generalizing across different case-based comparisons from around the world. And also, I think they were really interested in the kind of value of doing in-depth kind of comparative research and historically positioning or contextualizing comparative case studies. But the work that I'm interested in at the moment is called the new comparative urbanism. So it kind of setting itself slightly aside from that classic urbanism work, comparative urbanism work. And that's really what I'm writing about in the chapter in Tigran's book. This is a new body of work in comparative urbanism that's trying to create a truly cosmopolitan global urban studies. It's trying to decolonize global urban theory by decentering global urban theory from the north in particular, but also the focus on cities in the global north. You know, for a long time, it was London and New York that was dominating, Chicago School of Sociology. Then we went to the LA School, trying to decenter all of these kind of, you know, Euro-American global north cities. And this work was really exciting for me. So it kind of emerged in the early 2000s, and it's really grown in significance, I think. And it's become really influential, particularly on how newly minted urbanists around the world are doing urban research and thinking about cities globally. And of course, there's been a big push now to really take seriously the urban in the global south and the global east, which makes a lot of sense when you think of some of the mega urbanizations and the processes that are happening there completely, you know, kind of outfly anything that's happening in Boston outside my window here, for example. What it does is it acknowledges, I guess, the diversity of urban experiences. So it's also really interested in kind of grassroots grounded urban experiences from cities all over the world. And the one thing I really like is it kind of puts all cities on this kind of level playing field. So, you know, like New York doesn't, you know, kind of take over Portland in Maine or whatever. Big cities don't overtake small cities. They're not important. So some people talk about it as a kind of provincialism or kind of looking at provincial cities as opposed to global cities. And then, of course, cities in the global north as opposed to, you know, and kind of thinking through the global south. So I think the kind of critical bit of it, which lots of new kind of PhD students and postdocs of mine are really excited by, is how it writes against that Euro-American mainstream. And that is not easy. You know, we're so indoctrinated and saturated by, you know, Euro-American theory that it's really difficult to think outside that box and think outside that focus on that very limited kind of number of American and European cities, particularly in how we do theory. You know, so quite simply, every city has the potential to make theory.
Because I'm also wondering, like, how can comparative urbanism help cities?
Yeah, I mean, that's a really important question, because it's not just about helping academics in their careers and decolonizing global urban studies. Actually, perhaps much more important is, how do we help cities with this?
Yeah.
Well, I think one thing it's done for me that's really important is it's began to peel away some of these big conceptual labels like global city. And if you think about it, you know, cities all around the world are all aspiring to be global, whether it's Lagos in Nigeria or, you know, Shanghai in China. Mm. You know, they all want to be global in that very kind of, you know, kind of New York, London kind of way. And it's getting even policymakers and practitioners on the ground to start to rethink how we think about cities globally. You know, not just kind of comparing yourself to paradigmatic cities, but actually doing things differently, potentially. Mm-hmm. It also, I think, if you read deep into the kind of new comparative urbanism, it really gets you to think about who's talking for cities. And it kind of radically, I think, redistributes how we talk about cities. It's not just about, you know, kind of high flying academics. Mm-hmm. It's not about the Saskia Sassans of this world anymore. It's about people on the street. It's about policymakers, practitioners. It's about kind of looking outside the kind of norms of what we do when we look at urban theory. And I think that's really important for cities everywhere.
Yeah. And Loretta, you mentioned it's slow, the comparative urbanism. So how or what is the idea to speed it up?
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting. So it was slow when I wrote that chapter. It is beginning to speed up a little bit,
okay.
But I still think we've got an awful long way to go. Mm. And partly it's because it's very difficult to kind of break out of that kind of way of doing things. Mm. So, for example, this past week, I've got a paper coming out in Dialogues in Urban Research that talks about what I think engaged dialogue should be in urban studies. And what I talk about is the fact that actually we shouldn't all be talking like we are in this kind of podcast today amongst ourselves as kind of, you know, intelligentsia, kind of, you know, global urban studies scholars. But actually, we should be talking on the ground. We should be taking conversations, relationships with people on the ground, both the general public, community organizations and groups. And we should have them in this room. We should have them in this academic space, but not just have them in as these kind of tokens, but actually as mutually significant people who've got just as much to say, just as much intelligence on cities as we have. And we're not quite there yet in academia and urban studies. You know, we're still publishing as academics. We rarely publish with non-academics. And this is something I've started. So a couple of years ago, I decided to publish with a woman that I'd been working with in London who was being displaced from a public housing project that was being demolished. And I'd been fighting with her in public inquiries. And I thought to myself, why am I utilizing her knowledge of her displacement for my own value in my own career in this academic context? And then I thought, well, actually, I would like to publish with her and do a joint piece of work with her. But very few journals are interested in publishing that. Yeah. And eventually I kind of talked to the editors at City and they were like, yeah, we've never thought about this, but that's a really neat idea. And so I think I've begun to try to trigger debates about what we do as academics in urban studies.
What do you think, Tigran?
I actually thought about the same thing, but then you'll probably have to set up your own journal in order to do this. They're still very conservative about this.
Yeah.
I can't believe how difficult and, excuse me, tight ass they are.
Yep.
I agree.
And you sometimes get a review from somebody who doesn't seem to have really read your article. I'm astounded by that. There's a certain high-handedness that they're in charge. Those reviewers are the keepers of quality. I just won't get into that.
Setha, you want to say something?
Anthropology has been has looked at the urbanism from a world global perspective always, and a lot of the anthropology journals also are very comfortable with these kinds of articles and have a long, long tradition of writing with or highlighting the voices of those whom we work with. And so I would suggest anthropology journals. And I personally feel that urban studies, for whatever reason, has ignored a lot of the anthropology that has written about comparative cities and had organized a conference about it and it didn't work out. But to say that anthropology seems not to be a voice in urban studies, and yet that's where you would find a lot of your materials and your journals that have a long tradition, that would probably fit what you're trying to do. And that's an interesting disciplinary problem.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, to just kind of go back on that, so a lot of the work I've drawn on is from anthropology. So Michael Hertzfeldt's work, for example, right, where you do that, you know, you kind of join up with people on the ground and you write together and you do ethnographic research together. So, yeah, but anthropology, you know, in this supposedly transdisciplinary urban studies, certain disciplines still dominate. Geography, urban planning, sociology still dominate. Yeah. And it's an issue.
Yes. So, and with that also, we say thank you so much, Loretta and Karin, for being with us. And thanks a lot for contributing with your knowledge.
And for being part of the book, right?
Yeah,
the
yeah.
Athena series. Mm-hmm. I feel very fortunate.
Well, this has been a great honor. Yeah. This has been a great honor. I think the whole idea of the Athena series was remarkable. I really do, Tigran. It's just remarkable. And that we got to go there, really.
Thank
and
you.
We're so well hosted. I mean, unbelievably.
Unfortunately,
well,
COVID came in and there was a few speakers left, like as Loretta and a few others that were not able to come anymore. But
I didn't realize we
rectified that,
that
in the book, unfortunately. That was
just
difficult.
An incredible, I'm getting goosebumps.
Yeah,
it was
you.
An incredible kind of recognition. Really
thank you
was.
So much. Very just, kind. Yeah, I'm glad I was.
For me, as a kind of younger scholar still, I think for me, it was an incredible privilege to be part of this with Karin and Setha and everybody else in the book as well. I think it's a really, really good idea.
Yeah, thank you so much. One, I can just add that we're going to prepare a special version of this book for expanded for students only. So students will get a free copy of this book. It will be because I have the copyrights, and I will, of course, ask each and every author to say yes, so we can give them for free, because the book is pretty expensive for a plain student or graduate or undergrad.
That is the problem. I'm very lucky with my new book on public space. It's unbelievably expensive, but there is an e-version that's much better looking with colored images that I forget how much it is, but fortunately there is such a thing now.
But I think they will receive this for free. I can guarantee you this. So they will all enjoy your wonderful chapters in there.
So thank you again. And hopefully we're going to have more conversations like this.
For sure.
Okay, I'd like to say something that you probably can recognize. Mashallah.
Shukran. Thank you. Thank you. Take care.
Thank
you so much.
Bye. All the best. Bye-bye. Bye-bye. Goodbye.
Bye-bye. Bye.
So what do you think about the conversation we had?
That was wonderful. I have this privilege to know all of them. And somebody always said to me, it's like, is there anybody that you don't know? No, there's quite a few people. But I had the privilege to live in this generation to meet, to sort of meet all of these people. Mm-hmm. And then somebody said to me, you're like the Bob Geldof of urbanism. And I thought, okay, what does that mean? That means, you can put a live eight together, but your singles or your music is really bad. In a sense, your scholarship is not that great, which I kind of like. You know, I think it was, I hate Mondays or something. There was only one hit single by his group. Yeah. But he's put this together, and I like to put this, assemble people, especially this wonderful group. And we had the privilege to listen to Karin Frank and Seth Love and Loretta Lees, my good colleagues and friends. And I think wonderful three perspectives we heard.
Yeah, of course, like different scales, different perspectives.
Great, yes. Yeah. And the scholarship that they produce all the time, and also these always renewing new challenges that they come up with or actually raise very important research questions for all of us.
Yeah, and let's get back to you, the editor of this book. Tell me, what are the challenges you face when you edit a great book like this?
I'm trying to remember, this might be my sixth anthology.
Okay.
Before I had the series on urbanisms and beyond, one is still left to be done, and there was the emergent urbanism and a number of other ones. I would say the first one is always the most difficult one.
Okay.
The other ones, you know, you tend to think they're going to be easier. The challenges, as my colleague Emily Talon said, how do you put all these cats in one bag? So they can be female or male cats or in between or different transgender cats. But in a sense, it's actually very easy to do, but it's also very complex in a way that it should make a logical sense. The chapters should flow into each other. Sections should be connected.
Yeah.
There should be a message coming out of an anthology. Mm. Number of academics, including my late father, were skeptical about anthologies in a way, okay, how much weight do they carry in comparison to your own book or to a book on the subject?
Yeah.
But if you put them in the right way, and I think they do, they really do carry a lot of weight. And of course, it's, you know, it's like opening a book of stories. You can pick and choose, and you can find the chapters and the themes and topics that are interesting for you.
Yeah.
Of course, there's always difficulties. People might drop out from the books. They might have opponents and enemies, and they see enemies within, you know, in academia is sometimes a dirty place.
Okay.
It's not always nice. There's a lot of very difficult personalities and clashes of ideologies.
It's like people, they don't want to be on the same book with the other.
Sometimes, but I what I've always tried to do, and I'm sort of a little bit critical and negative about when you see anthologies that have the same feel and same ideological stance and same sort of atmosphere about it, then yes, it's fine. But then you don't have this sort of opposing clashes of views, which is very fruitful.
Yeah.
So I think from beyond the new urbanism, I think all the books have been very different, and that some I've had fortune to work with two of my colleagues, Christer Olsen and of course Hans Vesslund. We put a really nice post-urban world anthology for Routledge, which won the, I think, Regional Science Award a couple of years back.
Yeah.
So it's difficult, but I kind of enjoy it.
And in this book, there are like many, the co-authors or the contributors. How is the communication with them? How do you keep track? Okay, what is the status of each one of them? Is their text is done?
Sure. I think one of the things that made the work sort of transit more easier to work, the whole book, was that it was the result of the Athena lecture series. So we already had a prepared ground where everybody gave a talk and there was a paper prepared, although this paper changed dramatically until they came into the book. When you get them, then they start editing and then they come up with new ideas. And I think in the case of Seta, there was a whole new paper coming out and a number of other colleagues, which was fine because the initial idea was to do the transcripts.
Yes.
But we didn't really opt for that. Some basically have done that. And then the contact, you have to have one-on-one contact with each other and then sometimes with the group.
Yeah.
And also I had my colleague who was working in the center. She was a research assistant, Morgan Schwab, who was helping in the first initial stages to with the, you know, extra context and getting the editing articles in. And we also have an editor.
Yeah.
And of course, he passed the language editing at the end. And then finally, Roman and Littlefield as the publisher that came in on board. It's an interesting story about it was actually given there was three other publishers fighting for this book.
Oh, that's good.
It's good. I shouldn't put any names up.
Yeah.
And there was one before Roman Littlefield that was supposed to publish this.
Okay.
But at the end, I think it passed. It had very, really excellent three peer reviews.
Yeah.
But the publisher had some reservations or somebody at the board for specific things. They wanted to start changing things. And I was pretty adamant, I'm not going to change this extraordinary group in any way. If it's passed the peer reviews, everybody's happy about it.
Yeah.
And then, of course, Roman and Littlefield, jumped in, and it was a wonderful publishing company, but it was also a nightmare to work with them.
Because of?
Because in the editing process, a small communication, also the last version, there were some things missing. We rectified small things in the ebook. My intro, half of it is gone. That's why my introduction is short. I'm very open about these things. This is what happens at times, but it's okay. At the end, the final product is really good. It's not a very expensive book, which it shouldn't. If I was being asked, I would give all academic books for free.
How where can we find this book and buy it?
It's of course everywhere, in any online publishing outlet, from all the Amazons.
Yeah.
Of course, in Sweden, it's Adlibris and Bokus, and then you'll find them in all the UK, Australian, and American online bookshops. And of course, one can also directly order from Roman and Littlefield. And there's a code, we can actually give that
at the end of the show.
Where you can get 30% of rebate for that book.
Nice.
So,
like a lot of books that are being produced from, let's say, academia and people in academia, we as a practitioner is not really like reading or are in touch with these books. So how can we read and implement the knowledge that in these books?
That's a brilliant question. It's one that has been plaguing us, or all us academics in a way. Firstly, how relevant is my work within the academic society? How relevant is for decision makers and practitioners? Mm. Is the language user friendly? Is it too complicated or not? I remember reading some planning theory books, and I was a postgraduate student, and some of them were almost impossible to understand.
Okay.
You had to reread them twice. even, let's say, reading Bill Hillier's Social Logic of Urban Space, or Space is the Machine, you feel like you need to have a PhD in mathematics to understand it. But I think you're right. Sometimes I remember in research when people do PhDs, they do a popular version for practitioners or professionals, and I think if some of my PhD students have done it, which I think it's a great idea.
Yeah.
That's very difficult to do in this. When you do academic book, either you do it for your, partially for your career, for your students, for the academic assemblage or your colleagues. Mm. So how do you make these books relevant? You find probably more relevant, and I've seen this in the last 10 years, I'm not going to give names. That would mean I would probably give them, not to advocate, but boost up their sales. But I can take one example. It's The Soft City by David Sim.
Yeah.
That is a brilliant example of, I would say, a practitioner, but based in Gallo Institute for Research, how a book can be not just translated into so many languages, but extremely pertinent and practical for people on the ground, from activists to city makers or city advocates. So I think that's a great example. Then, of course, you will have books that, let's say, Richard Florida or Ed Glaser have done about cities, which become extremely popular because they're written in a sort of a bestseller type of form. And the language is understandable. It's I would say people wrongly sometimes say, well, they're not academics. And I say, wait a minute, you didn't say their body of knowledge. They produce hundreds of papers and their investigations were amazing. But then they also produced a key book that is basically geared for general audiences. So I would say if you have a message and if you have it's a strong one, you should maybe make it that way in a way. Make it a sort of like a bestseller book that, you know, that a mayor would read. Or I think it was Enrique Penalosa's brother, Gil Penalosa, if I remember correctly. He made a book about cities, which was maybe 110 pages with a lot of good pictures and text, which was simple but really good text. So I think one has to simplify the text at times.
Yes. Because my next question is actually about a lot of my colleagues and listeners. We have ideas that we might want to put them in the books and so on, but we are not like we are afraid of getting into this world of writing a book and getting a publisher and so on. It's like a headache. So what is your advice to us in case we have an idea or we have a topic that we can write about?
I think if you have an accumulated body of knowledge, practice-wise, and also some interesting theoretical developments, and you are situated in an organization that can carry you in a sense. Mm. Let's say Alexander Stolen made a really interesting book based in Spacescape. Mm. We talked about David Sim being in Gell. But also you can be independent, not being in that. And then if you feel there is something missing, I think you can also join forces with an academic from within the field, and maybe as a practitioner. We see rarely those combinations of academics doing with practitioners or academics doing with advocates, or let's say civil society people that are, let's say you do a book on social housing and you're academic with somebody who is in charge of a neighborhood group for maybe 20 years of incredible experience on the ground. Because, difficult, how do I get it? You're going to get it more easily published than a scientific paper because their journals are so rigid and conservative. Mm. So they'll ask, okay, where is this second person based? In a neighborhood group. Well, that doesn't work. Recently, I did a paper with somebody who was just in between different academic places.
Yes.
They said, well, you know, give us the university where he is. So he had to pull out an old university and just ask for some affiliation for a short while to get it published.
Yeah.
So I would say never give up on that. It's there is always a place for that. And I think those books are, honestly, I don't know, some of my academic colleagues would now be angry. They're much more popular than what we do in academia.
Mm.
They are, really. I mean, again, coming back to South City, it's incredible.
Yeah.
I mean, so many, if it's, that means the cities are interested. At the end of the day, it's going to be about work in the cities.
Exactly. Like that's making the change.
Absolutely.
Because what should I do? Like, if I have 1,000... book of 1,000 pages, but I cannot do implement any of these pages in my
for sure
kind of useless.
And I think that's one of the things that it's important. And that was interesting with the new urbanism movement, because it came both from academic and practitioner side.
Yeah.
So a lot of those practitioners brought in their ideas from their design projects, from whole civic town developments and neighborhood retrofitting and all that. And that started to sort of make real waves in the theory development in developing new concepts, and also influencing methodology, which is amazing
as well. Yeah.
And of course, with a lot of criticisms to all of that, but nonetheless, so it should be kind of both ways.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Because this is, I think this is the reality also. Like, reality is not only academia or practitioners. Like, it's a mix.
No, absolutely. I think I would have loved to see a book by Jan Gehl and Bjarke Ingels. That would have been an amazing book.
Never happened.
No, but Bjarke said
exactly.
I think he wrote something in one of his books. I love you, Jan. I learned everything about public space from you. And we know that Bjarke is in a sort of extraordinary post-urbanist architect.
Yeah.
But with a very, I would say, fine-tuned understanding of cities and sustainability and public spaces and so on.
Yeah.
So I think those mergers would be really, really nice.
Right, right.
Unless you have a person like Rem Koolhaas, who's basically done both, who is an urban theorist but also has his practice.
Yes.
I like his urban theory part, but not his practice.
Mm-hmm. So what is your a takeaway message to us who is going to read your book?
I think predominantly the book is really based in a way that, you know, the principles of feminist city planning should really start to matter in academia. And that we should start to sort of understand the structural inequality in academia, and also inequality in cities, in looking at how planning should be done. And it's not a breaking this patriarchal system, that we have a different lens of female scholars and female practitioners. So it's really geared towards students in academia. And at the end, some of these chapters, again, they're mostly academic. Mm. Maybe a follow-up would be something combining practice and academia, getting a follow-up book of different cases. Although I think a lot of our colleagues in the book take up cases that they have researched or looked at.
Yeah. And do you have a code or discount code for our listeners?
Oh, absolutely. There is a discount. Yeah, I'm not getting any royalties on, so it's good. The discount code would be RLFANDF30.
Mm.
So Richard Love Fandango America Norway David Fandango 30, and you get an off you get a discount of 30%.
Yes.
And I think that's also valid for the ebook. So ebook would probably be more acceptable in terms of price, but I know some people like to hold in their hand the physical. But I think we will have a follow-up, or we will have a next year. I will try to do a book extended version of this one.
Yeah.
Because there's three or four colleagues that were not able to make the book. Dolores Hayden and Anastasia Lukatis, and we had Chantal Mouffe and Patsy Healy and so on, that will complete this book really nicely. And then we will distribute it and give it for free to students.
That's great.
Which I think will be very nicely done within our own publishing house. And I have all the rights to do it. So it feels good.
Yeah. Thank you so much, Professor.
Thank you for having me. I think this is maybe the third time. Yeah.
Great.
And I hope last time I think I was like on speed. So I don't know if people understood what I was saying. Now I think it's a little bit slower.
Yeah,
but you can always slow me like you one slows records.
Yeah.
So it's really wonderful. And thank you for giving us the opportunity and the home to host this little book release, really, on women reclaiming the city. Unfortunately, due to COVID, we were not able to do it. And as it's such a big international assemblage of mostly women from Australia, UK, mm-hmm. and the US, it's hard to sort of, you know, where do you do the book release? Yeah. And I think it's in virtual space. It's best. And of course, you're going to do it in the best podcast in Europe. And that's where Urbanistica.
Thank you so much. So keep up the good work.
Thank you. Same. Thank you so much for having me.